Hey, and welcome to Unauthorized Disclosure. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Gastola.
Hey,
Kevin. And today, Kevin and I will be speaking to independent journalist Raven Rakia. Hey, Raven.
Hey, guys.
So we're going to be talking about Jordan Davis and the Michael Dunn verdict that came down last week. And Raven, you wrote a post about the verdict and sort of your reaction, and it was really powerful. So I guess, can you start off by just giving us your take, your reaction to the verdict?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for calling my post powerful. My reaction to the verdict was a little bit weird, because on the one hand, I was a little bit surprised by a few of the verdicts, specifically him being guilty for attempted murder. And I also was disappointed, of course, in the mistrial on murder of Jordan Davis. And what I wrote about in the post is, it was kind of, it kind of touched a few different points. My reaction was, at the end, I was very concerned with the other three boys in Jordan Davis's car, and how they're going to deal with, you know, seeing their friend killed in front of them. And I was also very impressed with Jordan Davis and how he handled his interaction with Michael Dunn.
So that actually was one thing that, like, that really moved, like, that I thought was really moving, that you mentioned in your post, is, like, this idea that, you know, no, like, Jordan Davis acted totally appropriately, and you mentioned you were, like, proud of him. You were proud of him for, like, standing up for himself and not turning down his music just because this angry white man was getting in his face about it. And I thought that was really interesting, just because, you know, there's always a sort of respectability kind of politics happening where, like, you need to be polite and, you know, especially if you're black, you need to talk to people politely so that you don't scare them. But, like, in this case, it's like, no, like, he shouldn't have to, you know, like, bow down because white people are uncomfortable with the music playing. So I don't know if you want to say something about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, of course, I was very proud of Jordan Davis. He sort of, in his interaction with Michael Dunn, which is really the only thing we personally know about him, he rejected respectability politics right off the bat. He refused to turn his music down. And I think what most people forget is that respectability politics, it really has a long history in the U.S., like the good black person versus the black person who's threatening. And it's the history goes back to slavery, and it's very racist. Sort of like the way people dress and the way people interact with white people. Like, if they go out of the way to say, make white people comfortable, back in the day, like saying, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, that was a good black person, versus the black person who didn't do that was seen as threatening, in the fact that they were defying white men. And so in this case, Jordan Dunn sort of defied Michael Dunn, sorry, Jordan Davis.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Defied,
yeah.
Michael Dunn. And then ended up dead after that. So it's a very interesting parallel.
Yeah. And then I also wanted to ask you about the situation with the prosecutor. In this case, I think it was Angela Corey, the Florida State prosecutor, the same prosecutor who prosecuted George Zimmerman, I think was a part of the prosecution team for Michael Dunn. I think that's right. And I just find it really interesting that, you know, she's with the Zimmerman case, I mean, that she was, you know, she failed to secure a guilty verdict. And then with the Dunn case, it was this bizarre, like, you know, they got the attempted murder guilty verdicts. But then, you know, the Jordan Davis, like, he basically wasn't convicted of murdering Jordan Davis. Like, it was his attempted murder of his friends. So I don't know. I just find it interesting that this is the same woman who prosecuted Marissa Alexander, who is a black woman who, you know, shot the gun in the air to scare off her abusive husband, and didn't hurt anybody. And she got 20 years in prison, which I think is being appealed right now. But, you know, Angela Corey threw the book at this woman. And then she's the same person that's, you know, that's prosecuting the George Zimmermans and Michael Dunns. And so I guess, like, do you think that she really, you know, that we can, do you think it's wise to rely on a system where people like Angela Corey are the ones prosecuting these situations, to rely on, like, a legal and court system that's just inherently racist and typically never works to secure justice for black people who have been wronged?
but I definitely don't think it's wise. And with Angela Cory, I mean, it's important to note that with Zimmerman, he wasn't even charged at first, right? Mm-hmm. There was a long battle just to get him to go to court in the first place. And then, of course, when he did go to court, there was a not guilty verdict. And then for Marissa Alexander, I mean, these are three high-profile cases that show a bit of the racial bias with prosecutors and also with stand your ground laws. A lot of people question why she used murder in the first degree for Michael Dunn. And I think that's a good question to ask. It's a very hard verdict to get. Basically saying that it was premeditated murder with the person he just met. It's a little bit difficult. It would be a little bit difficult to get that verdict. But it also says a lot of things about prosecutors in general. So these are the same people who are instrumental in the war on drugs, which is a racist war on people of color, locking up with harsh sentences, locking up people of color for marijuana possessions and crack possessions. And then prosecutors are the same people instrumental in the war on poverty or the war on poor people, where they lock up usually Black or Latino people for petty crimes when white people do it or when white kids do it, it's seen as like growing pains. Mm. So asking for these people for prosecutors to sort of be on our side in getting justice when a racist case like this comes up, it doesn't really make much sense. And they do it even with police brutality activism. It's very much focused on getting the police officer indicted, and then charged. And it even, you know, I've seen with police brutality activism in New York, it makes the activist sort of partner with the prosecutors. Mm-hmm. So the prosecutors agree to do an investigation, and then as long as there's they agree to do an investigation, and then activists sort of back off and they won't do civil disobedience. Because they want the prosecutor to sort of come out with to continue on with the investigation and eventually indict the police officer.
Yeah, no, I totally know what you're talking about, and that kind of plays into what I want to ask you next. And that is, like, with the police brutality cases, I mean, you know, what Michael Dunn and George Zimmerman did is so outrageous, and it should outrage people. They should be very, very angry and in the streets about it, right? But at the same time, it's really the same mentality that goes into the routine police shootings of unarmed people of color, almost always Black people, whether it's like Rekia Boyd in Chicago or Marley Graham in New York or Alan Bluford in Oakland, I think it is. You know, it's the same mentality. It's the same, like, oh, I thought he had a gun. Oh, like, you know, he wouldn't follow police commands. He wouldn't do as I said. It's literally, it's like the same kind of racial profiling and racism and that goes into it. Yet police shootings, like, don't seem to elicit the same sort of outrage that you see with the Trayvon Martins and the Jordan Davises. And so I guess I'm curious, like, why do you think that is? Why is it that when... You know, why is it that when someone has a badge, it seems to give them an extra layer of impunity from the public?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So I agree that when it's a stand your ground law or when the person doesn't have a badge, there's more outrage. I think there's more outrage with liberals. I don't think conservatives are really outraged either.
About anything, yeah.
Yeah, usually liberals are more outraged when it's a stand your ground law. I mean, Trayvon Martin... had the NAACP backing, like his name, when I was abroad, his name is known all over the world. Mm-hmm. And victims of police brutality aren't. So they had much more media attention. The NAACP was sending out weekly emails to their network about Trayvon Martin, and no victim of police killing ever got that from the NAACP, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's and I think it goes back to being able to scapegoat the problem to individual racism mainly, and also liberals not wanting to acknowledge state violence. Because to acknowledge state violence would mean to acknowledge that it's a bipartisan effort. It's not just Republicans, or it's not just the conservatives, or the outright racist people. and it's not just the southern states. You know what I mean? It's like, this also goes into scapegoating Florida and like trying to boycott Florida and saying it's a southern problem, right? So Florida's a swing state that usually votes Republican, has a Republican governor. So it's very easy for liberals to say that these stand your ground laws in these southern states, these southern Republican states, are the problem. It's basically an easy target.
That's a really, really good point. And yeah, I actually totally agree with you. And I guess turning a little bit, I did want to ask you, what your thoughts on this are. You know, there's been this comparison of like, not a comparison, more like an analogy that stand your ground laws in particular, sort of work as like a modern day 21st century version of, you know, lynching, I guess, like a legalized sort of lynching, right? And so I kind of wanted your take on that. Like, what do you think it's an appropriate analogy? And I guess if so, you know, what are the parallels?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand the analogy, and I think there are a lot of similarities between the two. It's hard to make a direct comparison just because lynchings were very gruesome.
Right.
But, I mean, the similarities are that it's done with impunity. No one goes to jail afterwards, and no one went to jail when Black people were lynched. And no one even tried to stop it. So when law enforcement heard about lynching before they were going to happen, because it was always announced, like no one ever tried to stop the lynchings. It happened, and then they shrugged their shoulders, and no one went to jail over it. So that's one comparison. To now, when people like George Zimmerman and police officers are getting off and not guilty charges or even not getting indicted sometimes. Another comparison is, like I said, the reason why people were lynched. Like, from investigative journalism from Ida B. Wells during that time show that lynchings were usually the false pretense was that a Black man raped a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually like under 20% of that of the lynchings even had that accusation, and usually it was because a Black person had defied a white person in some way,
mm-hmm.
Like we talked about before, or a Black person was getting too economically successful, and the white people felt like their wealth was being threatened. So I mean, those are two similarities I can think of, and then of course the difference would be that lynchings were mobs of people, two or three people.
Right.
The definition of lynching is two or three people have to participate in it for it to become a lynching. So, yeah.
That's actually really interesting. Well the part about the part that you said near the end about the sort of the getting, I guess, the economic, like being jealous.
Mm-hmm.
Like people sort of being jealous about the increase, you know, if like a Black person got economically successful, sort of reminds me of the sentiment among like middle class, you know, more conservative white men who, you know, with the economic downturn, it's like things are a little bit harder for them. And so if they see like Black people around them doing well, or just, you know, Black or brown people around them doing well, it's suddenly like, reverse racism is happening. Exactly.
You can even see it. I mean, I can't say this is definitely the case, but when you think of white police officers, which is working class or middle class white men who make, you know, a reasonable amount of money, but they're not rich by any means, and then they have to, and then where their racism comes in, it's like, I think a lot of the times when it's middle class or working class white men, a lot of the times it's like they need something to make themselves better than others, or they need something to separate themselves from, you know, people they see as lesser.
Right. It's like that's a part of their identity. It's like in society in general, it's like that's central to their identity, is their whiteness sort of being, you know, privileged, and so like giving them the privilege, even though they deny they have it. So I guess I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the role of implicit racism. And, you know, if anyone who's listening isn't familiar, implicit racism, it's something that we all have. It's like it's the kind of racism, it's not overt. It's sort of like it's conditioned. Like we're all implicitly racist because we grew up in a society, even those of us who aren't white, because we grew up in a society where everything around us, the media, books, television shows, movies, tells us, teaches us that, you know, black people, especially black men are criminals, and that, you know, that, that, you know, that I guess, you know, Mexicans are illegals. And I mean, it's like every, you know, all the stereotypes that come to mind when you think of certain people. I mean, we all have those embedded into our heads, whether we like it or not. And so even among those of us who like to think we're not racist, implicit racism really does play a role in our our perceptions and how we, you know, and what we fear. And so it's kind of like the one aspect of Stand Your Ground that, you know, it seems difficult to explain to people sometimes, right? Is that like perception of fear is different than an actual threat that you should be afraid of. And that even people who aren't raging bigots, like the George Zimmermans and Michael Dunns, who like are, you know, proudly don't like black people. Even those of us who aren't raging bigots may have these fears, regardless of whether, you know, we hate certain groups of people. And I guess like how that plays a role in racial profiling. And that, I think that's one of the reasons why, I don't know, this is like my own take, but that's one of the reasons why liberals are sort of loath to discuss the racial profiling that happens with police and like the state violence, because, you know, they have this sort of implicit racism too. And that would really, I mean, all of us, that would make everybody guilty of a really, really bad system. So I guess like, what are your thoughts on the role that implicit racism plays? And, you know, obviously like, what do you, you know, like what, I guess, do you think that people are in denial?
Yeah, definitely. I agree with a lot of the things you just said. I mean, I think the most dangerous part of implicit racism is not admitting it exists. Mm. So as soon as we don't admit it exists is when it when we can't acknowledge it is when it becomes very dangerous. And the same, like in Stand Your Ground laws, it's very hard for people to acknowledge that there might be a racial bias. And that's why it's such an issue. The implicit racism, like, historically goes all the way back to, it usually goes back to media propaganda, right? So what is always being put into our heads about race and what characters are black and what characters are white on TV shows and that sort of thing. Like, back in the day when there were racist minstrel shows, racist political cartoons saying black people were lazy and so on and so forth. Media imposing fear of slave revolt and then of black riots. And even like from science, studies saying black people were biologically inferior. I mean, all these things eventually were dismissed, but they are what excuse massive amounts of violence against black people. And then recently the media propaganda, that started with Reagan with like the war on drugs, the images of the black welfare queen taking advantage of the system, the black gang member, drug dealer, the black crackhead, all these things, these images that were put into our head over and over again, and they're still put into our head over and over again from Hollywood to, you know, the nightly news. And none of these things had any basis in real life. But that doesn't stop us from, like, getting these images in our head. So when we see the only black person on a TV show is the crackhead or the drug dealer, it's normalized because we've seen it for 30 years. What these things have in common with the Stand Your Ground law is all these images, what all these images have in common is that the presumed guiltiness of black bodies. All these people are black and all these people are guilty. And then so when Stand Your Ground law comes in, or racial profiling comes in, black people are automatically assumed guilty as opposed to white people.
That's really well said. Kevin, was there anything that you wanted to add in?
Well, just quickly listening, and thanks. It's been very provocative and important. And I wondered if, you know, one of the last things you could address here is this fact that prosecutors seem to go above and beyond to omit racism from bringing these charges. I think that has quite an impact on people understanding these cases when they're being covered and reported in the media, because, of course, journalists don't take any cues from the prosecutors that this is a racist case, and they don't talk about that. They, you know, like they said with this trial, it's the loud music trial, and that completely erases race from the case.
Right, definitely. And I mean, yeah, well, prosecutors do this in multiple ways. It even goes on, like, who gets to be on the jury. So prosecutors always try to eliminate racism from being a factor. So they'll try, so for the Michael Dunn case, they'll try to make sure that his racist letters that he sent in prison, like, doesn't really matter to this case. Like, his racial...
His letters, is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. like, his racism is sort of separate. His racism in the past to whoever it was is separate to the way he handled this case with four black people in the car. And it's interesting. I mean, it's usually so prosecutors can get off. And it's also plays into the need for a colorblind society, the need to say, oh, racism is over. Let's move on. Let's move forward. It's usually just so people don't have to take responsibility. And when we're talking about the loud music trial, I think that goes into trying to say it's not about race, but I also think that goes into respectability politics again. I think it's trying to say that, well, it's not really that he was black. It was that he was black and playing music. Like, if he was just a respectable black person, this wouldn't have happened. If he had played his role and done what he was supposed to do, maybe Michael Dunn wouldn't have felt threatened, and then he wouldn't have been killed.
Yeah, I'd love to see a white middle-aged man get as angry over, like, Justin Bieber's music playing loudly in a car. I don't want to see young white people a little bit more respectable. If he had just been a little bit more respectable and turned down that NSYNC or, oh my God, I'm so old. I just said NSYNC.
Anyway. Yeah, there's definitely lots of, like, pop music in general is, like, not the best thing ever. I mean, it's, you know, it's always provocative. It's basically like kids being kids. So it's a little bit ridiculous that it would be, this whole thing is about, they were playing their music a little too loudly.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so, so much for coming in to talk to us about these really, really important topics. We really appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Absolutely. All right.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Molotov Anarcho Radio Power Hour. Oh, wait, no, that's not what we're trying to do here.
Kevin, that's not on this show.
Okay, sorry.
It's our underground
welcome
show.
To another episode of Unauthorized Disclosure. I'm here with my co-host, Rania Kalek. Hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be taking you through several stories because there is plenty to discuss. And first, we're going to talk about just generally some of what we've been hearing about Ukraine and Venezuela. Rania, what's been getting to you this week as you've seen coverage?
Well, besides all the pictures that have been inundating my Twitter feed from news organizations, because apparently tweeting out pictures without any context of what's happening in these countries because they're, you know, crazy looking and violent. Counts as news. But so besides that, I mean, what's happening, obviously there's some serious, serious protests taking place in these countries. And there does seem to be definitely like legitimate grievances, and there does seem to be some state violence taking place for sure. But you know, Brett, I don't want to, obviously we're not trying to get into the more nitty gritty details, but I just do want to mention that it's pretty telling, that, you know, in both these countries, there do seem to be these elements of like right-wing oppositions that are very much supported in some way, shape, or form by the United States government. And in some cases, like in the case of Venezuela, you've got elements from a coup that the United States participated in 2002 who are at the helm of this apparent opposition movement that at least the U.S. media, you know, is saying are the leaders of this opposition movement. And it's very bizarre that the U.S. media is just really championing these protesters. And it's not that in itself is wrong. It's just strange because they keep calling them nonviolent protesters. They're not, you know, offering any context to the situation. And it's like, it's clearly these protesters, not all of them at least, are nonviolent. I mean, you've got them throwing Molotov cocktails, right?
Yeah, well, but you still got the State Department putting out things that suggest that these people are peaceful protesters, or the Obama administration in doing that, even though we can actually see them launching these Molotov cocktails.
Right, and I'm not, and you know what, like, I'm not saying that they don't have, like, legitimate grievances. I'm just pointing out, like, it's a fact. You've got protesters launching Molotov cocktails, and you've got the State Department still calling them, you know, completely peaceful protesters, and you've got the U.S. media really, like, parroting the U.S. government, as they often do, and foreign policy type situations. You've got evidence that the U.S. is involved in, like, the, I don't know if, you know, there was like a major report that was out in The Nation, and the man who wrote it was interviewed on Democracy Now, I believe, yesterday or the day before, talking about like a secret, you know, a recording that was leaked of top U.S. officials discussing participating in like a coup using the opposition in Ukraine. And, you know, you've got similar rumors about, you know, the Obama administration supporting a coup in Venezuela. So I'm just saying it's just bizarre that, you know, they're being called peaceful protesters. And it's clearly, you know, we're not being told the entire story here. And, okay. And I think everybody should treat this with definite skepticism. And you know, if you don't see nuance in the story, then it's probably not telling you the whole story.
Well, and it's rather schizophrenic, because it's, on one hand, the State Department and these other officials in U.S. government seem to be careful about saying, well, we think both sides are being violent. They need to come to the table. But then on the other hand, they'll say, but they're peaceful protesters. They're, you know, they've been out there, they've been doing protesting, and we think that they should be allowed to express their, you know, their freedom of speech and be out there and assemble and express themselves. And I think that the thing that isn't being asked, you know, because there is such this condemnation of, like, Venezuela for coming and cracking down on the opposition.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to condone necessarily, like, I don't want to make a blanket, do a blanket condoning of governments cracking down on people who are protesting. That's not what this is about.
Right.
But to say that there is clear historical evidence, which we hope to get into in a future episode, but just to say generally that there is history of U.S. meddling in the country. And what do you do if you are that government? How do you handle people who seem to be focused on spreading disinformation against a government, seem to be focused on fomenting this sort of resistance and destabilizing the country? They do have paramilitary forces in Venezuela.
Right.
And so I think that's just a question. We're not going to answer it today.
Yeah, I don't even know what the answer to that is, really. But I do think it definitely poses some things to think about in terms of the way it's being covered. And also, you know, one last thing I'd like to add is that I think it's really, it's very revealing that a lot of the sort of neoliberal types who are rooting on the protests, and when I say neoliberal types, I mean like in the media, mm-hmm. who are rooting on these protesters, a lot of them are the same people who call, like, you know, Black Bloc anarchists violent extremists because they break store windows. They're the same people who call Palestinians terrorists for throwing rocks at Israeli tanks. And so I think it's, like, really important to recognize the inconsistencies of the people who are at, like, the sort of leading voices championing the opposition and the calls for, like, regime change in these countries. Is like they clearly have an agenda.
Well, it's like in Ukraine, the protesters, they got to keep their label even after they were pointed at by, I saw in the Associated Press, you know, they were still called protesters even after they had kidnapped police officers.
Yeah.
And I, you know, hey, I know some people in Chicago that might want to kidnap some police officers that went after their activist group. And if they did that, they would not be called protesters by our U.S. media.
Oh, no.
So, I mean, as the contradictions are important. You have a couple stories that you want to get into and possibly raise and discuss.
And you do too as well. So here, I'll start off with one of the stories I want to talk about very briefly, which is there a few days ago on Wednesday night, I believe, there was a man in California near San Diego who was he was an undocumented Mexican national who was shot and killed by a U.S. Border Patrol agent for throwing rocks at officers who were chasing him. And, you know, a lot of the media reports claim that, you know, basically parroted the line that was given by the U.S. Border Patrol, which is that this man, as he was running for his life from U.S. Border Patrol, managed to throw a rock the size of a basketball. I quote, the size of a basketball at the head, which is really good aim, by the way, at the head of one of the agents who I believe, who shot him and killed him. So that's crazy on a number of levels. And, you know, this isn't the first time this has happened. The U.S. Border Patrol has a history of, you know, using live fire and killing people for throwing rocks at them. People who are, like, often trying to cross the border, a lot of times trying to cross the border to, like, you know, for the sake of survival, which is often the case. I mean, crossing the border is no picnic, you guys. It's not like something pleasant that people do because it's fun. They're usually running away from crazy violence and a lack of, like, any sort of opportunity in their own country, often the result of U.S. policies that screw their economies. But that's a different story. The point here is that this follows a pattern that's based on a policy that is encouraged by the U.S. Border Patrol leadership. A few months ago, the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol came out and said that rocks are considered, in his view, lethal weapons. And that's a quote, lethal weapons. And so when somebody throws a rock at one of his officers, that officer is totally justified in shooting back with live fire. And if they kill the person, then that's fine because their life was in danger. Because again, rocks, lethal weapons. So, I mean, it's like, I'm not really sure if I need to go into explaining why that's absolutely ridiculous. Obviously rocks, sure. You can, you know, take a big rock and pound someone in the head and possibly kill them. Okay. But like, this is absolutely ridiculous. And this is something that you see in other countries too. That's really upsetting when it comes to, like, you know, dealing with the unwanted others, the poor brown people that you want to keep out. This is something that happens a lot in Israel, in Palestine, where Palestinians who are, like, throwing rocks at Israeli tanks that are occupying their villages or, like, demolishing their homes, get shot at with live fire and sometimes killed. And then they're called terrorists for throwing said rocks. So I just think it's interesting, the parallel there. It's like, in my head, it's kind of like, once a settler state, always a settler state, you know? But yeah, I don't know if you want to say anything about that, Kevin.
Well, I don't have the number handy, but I know that there have been multiple instances of this where people are actually, you know, being killed because they threw rocks. So I guess to just say that, to emphasize that what you're saying is that this happens regularly and that the Border Patrol is defending this right to be able to shoot to kill these people as they are crossing the border. I think that's really important. And then the fact that these people who are shot and killed have absolutely no avenue to pursue wrongful death suits or to say that they were assassinated or executed by these Border Patrol officers. It's, you know, obviously they're not going to have any mechanism for challenging the fact that they were
killed. Actual Americans barely do as it is. So yeah, right. You can imagine someone who's undocumented.
So that's all I want to say.
And one more thing to add to that, that we were talking about before we started recording, was that the Border Patrol agent who did the shooting declined any medical treatment because his injury was so minor from the apparently basketball-sized rock that was thrown at his head, allegedly. So just throwing that out there. And the other story that I wanted to mention is equally as depressing, but at least nobody died yet. So the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, our friends at the Los Angeles Police Department, took a trip to Israel, where they toured, not the historic sites or anything. They actually toured, like, different, they actually toured areas like military bases, They met up with the cops in Israel, like the police departments or the state police there. And, you know, I guess exchanged notes. I'm not really sure what they talked about, but you can imagine they have a lot in common. And also they went to this fair, this Israeli company fair where they got to like see all these cool Israeli products. And Israel is like the number one exporter of drones worldwide, I believe. So they've got some fun, cool, technologically savvy new drones coming out. And the LAPD leadership that was there fell in love with the drones. There was one drone in particular called the Sky Sapien. No, that's the name of the company. I'm sorry. That was just as creepy. Sky Sapiens. I think that's how it's pronounced. It's just like exudes all kinds of, you know, this aura of protecting constitutional rights, right? Their drone, they make a drone called the Hovermast 100, and it's so creepy looking. And basically, this is how it's advertised on the website. I quote, "Whether your mission is locating illegals attempting to cross your border, crowd control at a political rally, or perhaps increasing security at your local electricity plant, Sky Sapiens' Hovermast 100, tethered hovering machine, combines engineering genius and innovative materials to provide exceptional observation and surveillance capabilities." So, chew on that. I added that last part in, but that is the way that this thing is marketed.
So what you're telling me is the LAPD is not considering buying American here in the United States?
That is right. That's like the whole point. That's the scandal here, which is absolutely... I mean, if I was Lockheed Martin, I'd be pretty pissed right now.
No, I mean, they had their... I just sort of... Not to stray too far from the fact that we're talking about Israel, who assassinates Palestinians with drones, and LAPD is going to take that technology and bring it back to Los Angeles and use that technology on people in L.A. But, I do know that there was a Singapore trade show, and we were hearing all about how there's all these drones and people who are manufacturing them, and apparently our export controls are just horrible here in the U.S. And it's just hard for us to get any of this stuff and, like, sell it to people. And we got Asian countries that we could sell our drones to, but, hey, we can't because the rules are too strict.
Yeah, what Kevin's talking about is this article. I think it was, like, in the New York Times or the Washington Post or something about this drone fair in Singapore. And these American drone manufacturers, General Automatic Atomics is what it's called. It's like
General Atomics. Yeah,
we're like complaining. The CEOs or the executives were complaining about how like the restrictions make it so that they can't sell their lethal drones to certain countries. But so those countries end up like Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia ends up buying from China instead, and how it's like bad for their company and bad for America. I mean, it was just like they were crying these tears of like, but that's a market that we're supposed to be selling to. And it was a ridiculously hilarious article
But what I guess the serious point is that maybe there's so much focus on what's happening with drone companies here in the U.S. and selling in domestically that maybe the LAPD is thinking, hey, we can get around this by just bringing the technology in from Israel.
That might be the case. I'm not sure, but that's a really, really good question. But on top of that, it wasn't just the drones. I mean, another thing that they were just gushing about, the LAPD leadership that was there, was going on and on about, like, because Israel is wonderful with, like, they create really wonderful surveillance technology. Like, they're really great. The NSA has contracted out to a couple of their companies, have actually been involved in helping the NSA wiretap Americans. And the reason that Israel is so good at these technologies is because they have a population that for the past, like, 60 years, they've had to learn how to control and dominate. And so when you have a population you need to control and dominate, it's like surveillance and drones and all these technologies are your friend. And so that's why a lot of Israel's products, it's like they sell really well as well, because they've been used. Like they've been like tested, if you will. I mean, the Palestinians are like a testing population. They're like lab rats for Israel's drones, whether it's the lethal drones. I mean, all Israel weaponry, all Israel surveillance technology is, you know, battle tested, if you will. So,
yes.
Just keep that in mind as well. And you know, with the LAPD going and wanting these things, it's like, it's really like sad in a way, because You know, that's not to say that the United States, you know, is any worse or better than Israel when it comes to treating brown people like crap. But, you know, the LAPD is really good at that. They excel at, you know, killing unarmed African-Americans and Latino people. And so it's just really interesting, that parallel of like the LAPD going to Israel and then trying to like adopt their surveillance practices and their counterterrorism practices or whatever it may be. And then coming back and using what Israel does to brown people in their country, using those same practices on brown people in their own city. So something to think about.
Yeah. And speaking of brown people, in New York City, is it okay if I transition?
Oh yeah, please go ahead.
All right. So, we've had a decision come down in Newark. It was in the District Court of Newark. A federal judge dismissed a lawsuit that the Center for Constitutional Rights had brought on behalf of Muslim plaintiffs. They ranged from individuals to groups. And these were people who alleged that they had suffered harms as a result of being spied upon by the New York Police Department. And some of you listening might recall that the Associated Press did Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting on what the New York Police Department was doing in Muslim communities. They had sent out a demographics unit, that's what they call it, a demographics unit, to do suspicionless surveillance in mosques, on restaurants. They were targeting student associations, and they were on university campuses. There was even one group of officers that had a safe house on Rutgers University. And this was discovered by a building superintendent, and he thought it was a terrorist hideout, and he called it in, and that blew the cover of the NYPD that had been on that campus. So this was something that the CCR brought forward, and now the judge has dismissed it. So just to quickly raise two of the key points that I think are the takeaways from this dismissal is basically the fact that, one, the way that this was justified as not being discriminatory, not being something that needed to be condemned by the judge, was that there was this earlier Supreme Court case. And I won't get into the specifics of it, but it had involved it's called Ashcroft versus Iqbal, and it involved FBI Director Robert Mueller and U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft. And right after the September 11th attacks, there were Muslims that were rounded up. And so this individual said that he had been subjected to discrimination that had been approved by these officials. And the Supreme Court said no. And what they said, and I'll read, quote, because this is pretty incredible. The September 11 attacks were perpetrated by 19 Arab Muslim hijackers who counted themselves members in good standing of Al-Qaeda, an Islamic fundamentalist group. Al-Qaeda was headed by another Arab Muslim, Osama bin Laden, and composed in large part of his Arab Muslim disciples. You got to emphasize Muslim here. It should come as no surprise that a legitimate policy directing law enforcement to arrest and detain individuals because of their suspected link to the attacks would produce a disparate incidental impact on Arab Muslims, even though the purpose of the policy was to target neither Arabs nor Muslims. On the facts, the arrests were likely lawful and justified by a non-discriminatory intent to detain aliens who were legally present in the United States and who had potential connections to those who committed terrorist acts. And so in this case, and it's almost nearly identical to the logic and theory that went into putting Japanese Americans into internment camps after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, or the attack on Pearl Harbor, you have the justification that they're not targeting Muslim communities. It's more likely that they were going into communities to pull out Muslim terrorists. So I don't know if you have anything to say to that, Rania, before I make another point.
I have to articulate my words in my head without using bad ones. So keep going.
It's infuriating. It's infuriating. And the next thing is that the judge adopted all of the arguments that the government put forward that blame the Associated Press for the suffering that Muslims were experiencing as a result of the New York Police Department. And essentially what I'm saying is He said, "Hey, they didn't know they were being spied upon until the Associated Press published these news stories. And then, only after that, did they begin to have these effects from the surveillance, where they felt like they couldn't practice their religion openly, where they were afraid to go organize and assemble and be part of the student association groups and plan activities. And only then did they think that they were going to have effects as being employees, and that their property was going to lose value because they were connected to places that were being surveilled by the NYPD. And so it's the AP's fault that they published confidential documents, and the NYPD is benevolent." And that's how the judge put it, is that they were trying to keep this secret. They were going to keep this under wraps so people didn't know it was happening. And so it's the AP, really, that these Muslims should be upset with.
Because that's such a bullshit argument on so many levels. And one of them being, like, the idea that Muslims didn't know they were being surveilled heavily and spied on is such crap. Like, they were told, I mean, it was pretty obvious when, like, people were getting randomly arrested and you'd find out that someone you were, like, that was in one of your circles was, like, an informant. I mean, it was pretty obvious that some crazy shit was going on. It was pretty obvious in the aftermath of September 11th when, like, Arab Muslims were rounded up in this country that things weren't going to go well for them. You know what I mean? So this idea that the Associated Press, by showing evidence, by offering proof that, yeah, in fact, you've been being heavily surveilled, and this is, like, all the policies that are responsible for, like, this is what the NYPD is doing exactly, is somehow, like, the first that Arab Muslims had heard of it, it's not true. It's bullshit. But even if it were true, it's still, like, suggesting that it's okay to surveil as long as the community being surveilled never knows. No, I don't think so. It's like your constitutional rights are still being violated. That's the issue here, not whether or not the people whose privacy was being violated knew about it.
Well, it's another version of what we had with Abu Ghraib, right? Where the photos come out and you've got people. Like, I remember Bill O'Reilly being very angry that you've got these photos going around of torture, and they're not angry at the torture, they're angry at the photos.
Yeah, because the photos are going to make the Arabs angrier at us, and then they're going to come at us even more. The terrorists are going to come at us even harder. It's like they knew that people were being tortured. Like,
right.
They didn't need picture evidence to know that, like, because, I mean, it's like they already, you know. We thought that, you know, maybe the U.S. thought it was, like, maybe, like, the media thought it was conspiracy theories at the time. Like, I'm sure that, like, people, you know, before there was a lot of, you know, hard proof, that people thought that Arabs and Muslims were just being paranoid.
Like, right. And so in reality, where we have facts and things happen in a reasonable way, or we'd like to hope they would happen reasonably, you have to have proof before you can go to a court and allege that you've been discriminated. And the AP, to their credit, by doing this journalism, this good investigative journalism, provided mm-hmm. Muslims with the ability to go defend their rights. And so that's basically all I have to say on that. The next story and final story that I think we want to raise and just get into a little bit is we had the decision come down in the United Kingdom with David Miranda. David Miranda is Glenn Greenwald's partner, and they live together in Brazil. And David Miranda is someone who had been detained in Heathrow International Airport when he was traveling back to Brazil. He was leaving Berlin. He had been with a journalist that Glenn Greenwald worked with, Laura Poitras. She's been reporting on the documents from National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden. And Miranda was under a terrorism law. The United Kingdom terrorism law was detained for the maximum period of up to 9 hours, had electronics seized, and the Security Service in the UK would have us believe that they seized that material, and they have 58,000 copies of documents that they found there. And they made all these arguments in court that they had to stop David in order to ensure that they were protecting this material from getting out to other adversaries, of UK adversaries, and they needed to prevent risk to life. I can read you one of the things that they had. It says, intelligence indicates that Miranda is likely to be involved in espionage activity, which has the potential to act against the interests of UK national security. We therefore wish to establish the nature of Miranda's activity, assess the risk that Miranda poses to UK national security, and mitigate as appropriate. And they asked for a port stop, and they stopped him back in August of 2013. And the stop really shows that they have these journalists under surveillance, because they have this in one of their notes that they gave to the police who did the stop. The agents were given this information. We strongly assess that Miranda is carrying items which will assist in Greenwald releasing more of the NSA and GCHQ, GCHQ being the UK spy agency. This material we judge to be in Greenwald's possession. Open source research details the relationship between Poitras, Greenwald, and Snowden, which corroborates our assessment as to the likelihood that Greenwald has access to the protectively marked material Snowden possesses. So, the big deal here to talk about is just that they don't have to know. And this is my advice to people on basically not taking anything that they intend to use for a major investigative journalism piece with them when they're traveling through the UK. Because if those agents have any reason to think that you might appear to be somebody who is carrying top secret or secret material that could be published and used and exposed the intelligence agencies, and that material, you know, they might believe terrorists could use that to their own advantage. Anything that's published can be used by terrorists, by the way. Just generally speaking, in the way that the internet is set up, the terrorists can use the information in the same way that you or I can use the information. So we're all terrorists to some degree, because we can read information that comes out about what people are doing in secret and decide how to act nonviolently or violently. Most of us nonviolently. But here in this case, what's really dangerous is that as you are traveling, they can just stop you if they have any reason to think that you're giving off the appearance that you might have materials that you would like to release. And then you get basically treated and criminalized like a terrorist. And that's quite a crackdown on press freedom.
I mean, that's really scary. I mean, that's essentially like terror, you know, it's journalism. I mean, that's why as much as I, you know, criticize America, we're really, really lucky that we have a First Amendment, because that's really all that's like standing in the way of those similar kinds of decisions being made here. Right. And that's, you know, that's one thing that sucks for people in the UK, because like they don't have a right to free speech, right? Like there's nothing that really guarantees that the way it does here. So
yeah, and just a reminder that in the UK, the GCHQ sent people to destroy the Guardian's hard drives because they had once had material from Snowden. Prime Minister David Cameron has actually endorsed Parliament investigating the Guardian journalists who have been doing coverage of these leaks. There's actually a journalist who writes for The Independent who wrote this you can stand in awe at this chain of words. If the security services insist something is contrary to the public interest and might harm their operations, who am I to disbelieve them? Wow. And so just, you know, essentially UK has been far worse in comparison to our country, but that doesn't make us, a free society necessarily.
Not by any stretch of the imagination.
So, and that's basically all I have to say. At some point, you and I should have a discussion on this show about all the people who are exiled and this idea of whether to confront power and, you know, just, you know, quickly
well,
to
we
say
have,
that
we have like a good, you know, we have like a little over 5 minutes left if you want to.
Well, I mean, just the thing I wanted to mention too here, and this happened in the same airport, is that one of Snowden's lawyers, Jesselyn Radack, was there and traveled to the U.S. To the U.K. And was going to the Ecuadorian embassy where Julian Assange happens to be, where he was granted asylum by Ecuador. And they were going to have a meeting with people, all of these like whistleblower types. Thomas Drake was going to come, Ray McGovern, Annie Machone is a MI5 whistleblower. And these people were going to gather and they were going to have a meeting of some of a group called the Sam Adams Associates. And she was stopped. She was interrogated. It was barked at by a Border Force agent and asked really uncomfortable questions. The person seemed to know a lot of details about what she had done in her background and history, and asked her things, too, that were just kind of strange, like, who is Bradley Manning? And asked her even, where is he? And she's like, well, he is in jail. And I recognize that Bradley's now Chelsea Manning, but the Border Force agent was saying Bradley Manning. And the thing of it was, is like, this was so nerve-wracking to her that afterwards she got emotional and she was crying. And the thing I just wanted to put to people is I was getting multiple comments that someone in the line of work of what Jesselyn does, this representing whistleblowers, people who are considered enemies of the state by governments, like, she should have this ability to not get so emotional that she almost doesn't have a right to get upset when she is mistreated.
It, and just because she should like expect it, like she should expect to be treated that way and avoid it. Like if she doesn't want to get treated like that, then she shouldn't be traveling there. Like it's like somehow on her.
Yeah, so I find that to be just the absolute wrong thing to think about. I mean, beyond the fact that it is obviously blaming the victim, I just don't see what the point of that sort of statement is.
Well, I think it's also like saying you should give in. To think that way, that kind of mentality of like, you know, Glenn Greenwald, like, what does he expect? Like, of course, he shouldn't be trying to come back to the U.S. and provoking something. Like, if he doesn't want to be prosecuted, then he should just, you know, then he should just sort of give in. And, you know, that's just the U.S. wins on that front. It's like, no, that's not what it's about. Like, she shouldn't have to worry about traveling to other countries. She has done nothing wrong. And she has every right to get upset when she's treated that way. She shouldn't be, there shouldn't be no expectation of this is how you're going to get treated. Like, that's just like, there's so much wrong with that. Jeez, I don't even know where to start. It's just wrong. Like, it's, you know, okay, it's like protesting. Don't protest if you don't want to get manhandled by the cops. Like if you get pepper sprayed by the police because you're engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience, well, that's, you should have expected it. You should know better. Like, no, like you should be able to go and protest without being physically assaulted. And the same goes for like people who, you know, whistleblower lawyers and whistleblowers themselves and investigative journalists and, you know, you should be able to travel freely just like everybody else without being harassed and assaulted and barked at.
Yeah, it's the wrong reaction because you should keep the focus on the government. The government, those are the people who are in the wrong. We're talking about infringing on attorney-client privilege here.
Right.
Whatever they are getting on Jesselyn, they're going into her communications, and she's has a legal duty, not to mention a right, to be representing these clients, and that is supposed to be protected. Now, I recognize, like, the reality is that we have governments that don't respect attorney-client privilege, including and especially the United States. And importantly, because you and I being U.S. citizens, we should be chiefly concerned with what the U.S. is doing to violate attorney-client privilege.
Right.
But that doesn't make it acceptable. I mean, and I don't think people are saying that's acceptable, but that doesn't mean that she has to just learn to cope with it and not have human reactions to the treatment. So I just think that's important.
Well, I think also you bring a really good point of like, don't let that be a distraction. Like, I think that like, because a lot of the people who were saying this, it's not like they were people who were against what Edward Snowden has done or against like whistleblowing. These were people who were like typically on the same side.
No, I just think that these are people who are very cynical and they they don't see power ever changing. And I'm not going to necessarily say that I disagree, but just to say that let's get back to the fundamental role of nonviolent resistance and of also confronting power and the value of having people who are willing to take a stand. And you're not going to be encouraging that sort of activity if when they do that, your reaction is, oh, well, why are you crying? I can't believe you didn't think that that would happen to you in an airport.
Right.
And so I'll just leave it there. So Rania, is there anything that people should be reading this week at your website?
I mean, I'm not sure what to throw out now. I've got a couple of things coming out. I just don't know exactly when, but I will, you know, if you follow me on Twitter at Rania Kalik, you know, I'll definitely tweet out my stuff regularly. And I imagine the same goes for you, Kevin.
Yeah, excellent. I am glad to invite people to follow you. And also, if people want to look at my work, they can come to firedoglake.com. And of course, I'm on Twitter at kgostola, K-G-O-S-Z-T-O-L-A. And we're very happy that we've managed to get everything together. We've got our Tumblr up where we'll be putting up the podcast. We're finally on iTunes. We can broadcast that loud and clear to all of you who were putting the pressure on us to get it together and get it on iTunes. You can now find us by looking for Unauthorized Disclosure on iTunes. And we're continuing to put the finer touches on this podcast by having, you know, graphic logos, maybe possibly in the future doing some more with the intro music that we have for the show. And
we're also
continuing to involve you and invite you to who are the listeners to contribute to the show and inspire us in ways. So thank you for listening and have a good week.